You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host, and today we're lucky to have with us author Peter Heller. Welcome, Peter. It's been a little over a year since we talked last.
Yeah, good to hear your voice again.
Same here, and I really appreciate you coming on today. I'd like to talk with you about your new book. You know, Peter has written several nonfiction books and fiction books like The Dog Stars, The Painter, Celine, The River, and then your most recent that I'm excited about today is The Orchard. And my first question is, why from a woman's point of view? And it's just really fascinating to me, and it works really well, I think. What was the decision that made you decide to do it that way?
Right. Well, I never hardly ever make any decisions when I'm writing. I mean, I do once in a while, but I always sit down. Until the COVID deal, I was writing in a coffee shop every morning, and I'd go there and I'd sit at the table, and when I was starting a new novel, I just listened for a first line. I came up as a poet, and I'm sort of more interested in the music and the language and the plot, which is sort of funny for a novelist. But I begin with a, you know, whatever first line sort of flutters down, and it's one that whose music I'm interested in or I love, and I just kind of follow the first line into the next, and the music and the cadence of the next line and the next, and before you know it, you know, we're in a place and there's the voice and a character. And this time, the voice that I bumped into right at the start happened to be a 7-year-old girl named Frith.
That's amazing, because then you're opening yourself to the creative voices that come to you, and I don't think too many people can do that. So that's an amazing way to start your novel that way. It really is.
Well, I was going to say it's fun. I mean, it's fun. I always want to have as much fun as the reader. So if I don't really know where I'm going, so you know, you come around a bend in the story, and you never know what's going to be there, and it's always exciting like that.
Oh, well, exactly. Yeah, and you know, I couldn't find a hardback copy to buy, so I downloaded The Orchard on Scribd.
Yep.
Scribd.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
Is there a print edition?
Yeah, so here's the deal with The Orchard. I've been writing a little bit faster than my publishing house, Knopf, can keep up with. So I've been finding some other channels to publish the novels that come, you know, more quickly than every 2 years. And so we tried this thing, Scribd. It's like a Netflix for audio books and ebooks. It's a subscription service. And the interview now is sort of timely because they get it for a year with their subscribers. And in about 2 months, sometime in September or October, The Orchard will go out to everyone, you know, on as an ebook and audiobook on Amazon and on Barnes and Nobles, on any local independent bookstore that sells ebooks, and so that'll be great. And then they have to figure out some way to print it.
Right.
So that'll be good too.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, on your website, you really write like a poet. I mean, you do. As a poet myself, I really appreciate that. And on your website, it says at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, you received an MFA in fiction and poetry. And you won a Michener Fellowship for your epic poem, The Psalms of Malvine?
Is that? Yep.
And I tried to look that up and couldn't find it anywhere because I'd really be interested in reading that poem.
You're a good researcher. So yeah, I wrote this 100-page epic poem about a bad guy in the old West, and I published a couple. It's 96 linked poems, and I published a few of the individual poems, and then stuck it in a drawer. So there it is.
Okay.
Maybe one day we'll publish it.
Maybe so. That would be great. Yeah. You know, and what I like too about your website is that you've been a dishwasher, a construction worker, a logger, an offshore fisherman, kayak instructor, river guide, and world-class pizza deliverer. So I appreciated that in your bio from your website.
Well, writers have to piece it together however they can, and you do whatever you got to do.
Well, exactly, and having that broad of experience also tends, I would think, to lend a lot of words to your ability to draw from those experiences.
Yeah, when you know, that's the great thing about knowing that you want to be a writer, you know, you're going to be a writer when you're really young, is that you sort of don't mind all the crap that happens because, or all the job, you know, the crazy jobs you have to do because you think of it all as fodder. So,
right.
I lived in the back of my pickup truck for a couple of years and just taught kayaking and worked outside, and you know, I didn't mind it at all. I had an old typewriter under the bed, box of books, and it was great.
Do you still write with a typewriter?
No. Thank God.
Yeah, really? Really? I tried.
I am old enough to know where cutting and pasting actually comes from.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, that's someone gave me an old typewriter, but I don't really have any desire to bring it up to working speed at all.
No. Word is awesome.
You know, as a poet, I find the poems that are written in the orchard are well done, and that whole period of time in the Chinese Tang Dynasty, isn't it, that you draw from there?
Yeah. So in the orchard, the little girl, Frith, who's speaking, she's seven, and her mother, Haley, is a legendary translator of Tang Dynasty poetry. And the Tang Dynasty was sort of 8th, 9th century AD in China, and it produced some of the greatest poetry that's ever been written, in my mind. And classic poets like Li Bai and Du Fu and Wang Wei, people can look them up. But the thing about that poetry is it's so simple, and they're usually, you know, just a few lines, and they immediately take you, you know, knee deep in a creek or on a mountain pass with the clouds shredding in the pines, and you know, the croak of a heron by a river. And these poets are so beautiful and so simple, and they're aficionados of loss. I mean, these guys, they're sort of like the original blues men. They, in just a few lines, they can take you to a place. It's usually wild nature, and just skewer you with, you know, the sense of sort of the exquisite loss that we, you know, all bear in our lives. And it's just my favorite poetry on the planet. And so this Frith's mom, Haley, she translated a woman poet named Li Shui, who lived in early 800s in Western China, in Chang'an, where the court was. And she lost her husband in one of the wars that was raging then on the frontier. And she took her little daughter, who was about the same age as Frith, and retired to the country to an old orchard. And so Haley does that with her own daughter. Her marriage breaks apart in Denver, where she's a professor. And, you know, already at age 34, this revered translator. And she takes her daughter to a defunct orchard in southern Vermont, in Putney, Vermont. And the book begins there, and it's just about, in the beginning, about the two of them and their dog, Bear, and their friend, Rosie. And Haley is working on her second book of poems by Li Shui, which will probably be called The Orchard Poems. And that, you know, that's where the book is. And then you know, the novel has a bunch of Li Shui's poems in translation, and that was really cool to include.
I thought so, too, and of course, you're the author of those poems, right?
Yeah.
So that even made me...
Li Shui is fictional, so...
Exactly.
You know,
so.
I was reading in Crested Butte last fall, and I was doing a reading for The River, which was the novel before this, and... someone asked what I, you know, was working on. I said, well, you know, The Orchard's just coming out. And a woman came, and I described it just as I did just now. And a woman came up afterwards, and it was in the little stone library there in Crested Butte up on the second floor. And, there was, you know, it was really fun, packed house. And a woman came up afterwards and said, you know, I'm a translator of Tang Dynasty poetry. And she was an older woman, and she, you know, she said, I've been doing that my whole life, and I'm a professor. And so I said, well, I have to send you a manuscript, and I'm going to do it with trepidation, but can you please take a look at these quote-unquote Tang Dynasty poems? And I was so relieved when she emailed back and said that they were convincing and good.
Yeah, that took a lot of nerve and verve, I think, for, you know, to do that for that very reason, because you're going to come across somebody somewhere that's going to know it and know the,
gonna know a lot more than I do. That's what you're going to run into. Yep.
But what I really like is I you gave credit to Kenneth Rexroth in one of, I think, in the book somewhere, and
yeah.
And I looked through my library trying to find that one book that he had written that I knew I had, and I guess I loaned it out. But there, you're absolutely right. Those poems are so alive, and simple yet profound, because it takes you down where they're going, and that's pretty amazing to be able to do.
Beautiful. I'd recommend that to any of the listeners. If you're interested in just dipping a toe into ancient Chinese poetry, Tang Dynasty, Kenneth Rexroth wrote a little book, translated a book called 100 Poems from the Chinese, and then 100 More Poems from the Chinese. And it's Kenneth Rexroth, and it's just a stunning little volumes. Yeah.
You know, the ability to write about Vermont. Have you lived in Vermont before?
Yeah, I sort of grew up there half my youth. I have a lot of relatives. I grew up in New York City, and when I was 15, I had an uncle and aunt and a bunch of cousins in southern Vermont. I begged my parents to let me go away to high school there, so I did. And it's a part of the world that, you know, I've been in and out of my whole life. I love it there.
You know, since I have an electronic version, I don't know if the pages are the same as the book you probably have before you, but there's a section in there on page 179 of the digital version. Just the description of to me is so good about the outdoors. And this is a program that talks about the land and the outdoors. And I don't think I'm going to be able to read it like you would, but
I think I can get it. You know, the thing about going on this PDF is they let you go to a page. So
yeah, it's page 170, 179. Yeah,
okay.
You could read some of that. It's just really great writing.
That's right. Oh, now it doesn't.
We turn the corner of Osgood's house is somewhere in there. I think would be if you can
Osgood. Yeah. Okay.
Turned the corner at Osgood's house and got on the trail called Blueberries.
Oh, you know what? Well, I'm searching. You know what I can do? I can search my manuscript. But while we're doing that, ask me another question, and I will find that. I promise.
Well, what are some of the stories from your childhood that you brought into your writing from Vermont?
Well, I put, you know, what was really fun is I put a bunch of my cousins in there. And I think there's a Geordie, and Chris Osgood is my cousin-in-law. And so I put a lot of people in there that I actually know, which is really, really fun. And the descriptions of the orchards and the hills, the neighbors, you know, they're all, you know, sort of as written. It's you know, the hills above the Connecticut River, in it, above a town called Putney, Vermont. And, you know, I described it all as I have sort of taken it all in through my skin and my cells, you know, running those trails, skiing through those cross-country skiing through those woods and camping all in there and stuff. So, yeah, you know, it's really a part of me. I mean, I can close my eyes and I can smell, you know, what those woods smell like in mud season when we were used to sugar. We used to carry, you know, 5-gallon pails full of sap and take them to the truck and take it to the sugar house. I could smell the mud and the, you know, the melting snow and, you know, the rotting leaves and all of that. You know, it's sort of in me, so it wasn't too hard to do.
Well, it really comes out well, and just the description is really good, because that's about that portion that whether we find it or not, about Putnam Mountain and the Blueberry Trail. It's just, you're right there, you know, with that feeling. So it's really a...
Yeah, I just found it. Let's see.
Okay, good.
We turned a corner at Osgood's house and got on a trail called Blueberries, which wound up the backside of Putney Mountain. The first bracing morning, the first that presaged fall. Bear, he's the big dog, ran ahead and made wide circles in the woods, came back. The early sun spilled through the canopy and patterned into the ferns. I could smell them warming and begin to see at the edge of the trail, poking out of old leaves, the crimson bodies of newts. There's a time in these woods, on these hills, when walking the trails is like swimming through honey. The color, not the viscosity. It may be all the birch trees and ash and birch, all the trees that soften to yellows early, before the onslaught of the more brilliant colors. Some of the hedges and underbrush were already turning too. The sumacs were reddening. But the prevailing mood is something golden, and the forest takes the sunlight on a cold morning, the first that felt almost like frost, and transmutes it into something suitable only for memory, what it feels like.
Wow, yeah, that's a great portion there. I really liked when I was reading the Orchard. You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake, and our guest today is Peter Hiller, best selling author, and we're talking about that book, The Orchard, and his most recent book. You know, I had cousins too. What you're talking about, it was so fun to have cousins to grow up with because the things you get into and the things they get you out of, it was a similar thing in my life. And so I appreciate you letting us know that that's some of the people in the book were your cousins.
Yeah, and you know, a few of those are still, you know, some of my best friends. It's great.
Yeah, cousins.
I have two lives to live. I live one in the Connecticut River Valley and one out here. But, you know, it's interesting, after settling out in Colorado, and maybe this is an experience a bunch of the listeners have had, too, but I thought when I was living in Vermont and New Hampshire, I thought there was no more beautiful place on the planet. And, you know, there probably isn't in many ways. But, you know, I came out west as a kayaker first, as a paddler wanting to run, you know, big water rivers and not paddle when it was early April and there was ice, you know, in the water and snow on the banks, which is what you do in New England. I came out here and, you know, once I started living out here and under the big skies and having, you know, the big vistas and the big mountains and the, you know, all that big wild country and all the public land that, you know, you can run and ramble in. You know, once I lived here for a few years, it's funny now when I go back to Vermont and visit, I love it, I adore it, but after a couple of weeks, it's really weird. You know, I start to get claustrophobic, and it's just like, it's the woods, it's not enough sky, you know, it's just all the dense hardwoods everywhere, and you know, there's not a lot of, you know, public land. I remember, you know, taking my wife to Canoe River in Vermont, and it was hard to find a place to get out because it was all private.
Right.
Which is not what you run into, you know, on the Colorado River.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. So I love going back to visit, but I don't know that I could live there anymore. You know,
yeah. I had my family grew up in the South, and I'd go back to see my granddad in Oklahoma, and the humidity was just something that I had a hard time with, having grown up in the Southwest.
Right.
So yeah, it's what are some of the other projects you're looking forward to doing? You have anything that you're working on at this time?
Yeah, just finished the novel. You know, a few weeks ago, I'm doing the revision right now, and it's Jack from the River.
Oh, good.
The river's about two best friends, you know, and running a river way up in Canada that runs into Hudson Bay, and they're college age kids, and Jack is one of them, and he's a ranch kid from Western Colorado, from near Kremling. And it's Jack a couple years after the river, and he's working as a fishing guide over on the Taylor by Crested Butte, and that's how the new novel starts.
Good, yeah. That's I found The River to be a really powerful book, and when you were here last time, I think it had just come out.
Right, that's what we talked about.
Yeah. So September, we can look forward to folks being able to get the digital version then of the Orchard. Is that correct then, like you said?
Yeah,
earlier?
September, October. They're figuring out a publication date right now for that. You know, letting it loose
right.
on the public.
What advice do you have for any young budding writers that, since you took a workshop from academia, do you have any ideas that you could impart to some young writers might be listening?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say I can think of three of the greatest things anyone ever told me to do. One was Jory Graham was a poet I studied with at Iowa, and we were talking about how poems begin. And someone was saying, well, I don't know if, the editor at this magazine would like it or the readers will get it. She said something that I'll never forget. She said, I think every work of art begins, is a question, and, the poem or the painting is the answer. And she said, well, why ask the question of the reading public or the editors or reviewers or the market or your teacher? Ask the question of God.
Wow.
Why not aim high? And I always, that really struck me, it's like whatever God is to you, I'm not a religious person. God to me has to do with the wind and the trees and the sound of a creek. But it really, really struck me, it's like when you're writing, forget about, what your professor's going to think or your editor or whomever, ask the question of the most deep, go to the most deepest sacred place to you to explore, those questions. And I thought that was really great. The other thing is I write, every day when I'm writing, and I think it's really great to have a quota and stick with it. I write 1,000 words a day every day, and I always stop in the middle of a theme that excites me. And that's really important. Once I discovered that, my whole relationship with my writing changed, because most of my writer friends, and I did too, will get it, they'll have their quota, 500 words a day or 3 hours or whatever. But when they get excited, they'll, keep on going with a scene, write triple that, 3,000 words, write all day long.
Right.
But when you do that, it's natural to want to do that. But when you do that, you put down the laptop or whatever it is, and you go, whew, that was awesome. Go on with your day. And then you get up in the next morning and you go to a double return, a transition, and white space. And you're facing white space. And you might as well start the book every morning if you do that. Roll that rock up the hill, get it going again. So Graham Greene used to write 500 words a day every day of his life. He was a great novelist. And
right.
He would stop at word 500, but I realized he was stopping in the middle. So what I do is I write my 1,000 words. I never go less than that, but I go just past it till I'm in the middle of something exciting, and then I stop. And then I can't wait to jump out of bed the next day and keep going. And it's a great way to generate momentum.
Well, that sounds like some really great advice, Peter.
Yep.
Really it is. Listen, so good to have you back on KDNK again, and looking forward to your next book. And one of these days, it'd be great for you to drop in here, and we'd have a reading or have a bunch of people show up.
It'd be great to see your face and everybody else's. I'd love to.
Thanks again, Peter, for coming with us, and thank you, listeners, for listening to KDNK. Our next show is August 11th at 4:30, and until then, whatever you do to Mother Nature, do it for land's sake.